incredible time. Thank you for all coming. It's a pleasure to be visiting Deal again and then going home.
Brooklyn.
Oh, am I we're in Brooklyn right now?
Looks like.
I'm going to begin with two introductory statements, both of which I think are extraordinarily important. And I want everybody here to pay very careful attention to both of these statements. In fact, most of our discussion tonight will revolve around these two introductory statements. I'm going to begin by making the somewhat absurd statement that I am absolutely, without a question, underqualified to teach this particular class. Or better, as will be developed, you'll see that I am only one half of 1/3% of underqualified to teach this class. To properly teach what we're going to do tonight, one needs to have semicha, rabbinic ordination, and not any old rabbinic ordination semicha, because not all semichas. Good to see you. Sorry.
Okay.
Message, Pat?
Yes.
Thanks. Cryptic. Don't worry about it. Not all semichot are the same. Traditionally, a semicha is a rabbinic ordination where you study Talmud and you study halacha. That's what most people will get semicha all about. In fact, your semicha says yore yore, which means you've mastered yore de'ah, and all the Talmudic background to that as well. However, one could also get a semicha which emphasizes not only Talmud and codes and psak halacha, but also biblical literature as well as a healthy dose of biblical commentary, or known as parashanut. Not only does one need that kind of a semicha, as well one should have a PhD in philosophy, deal with some of the issues that are going to come up, and in fact, that's not enough as well, one should also have a PhD in one field of science or another, for an obvious reason. If you're going to discuss issues of science and religion, or science in the book of Bereshit, then one has to be able to obviously understand and handle Bereshit and its Parshanut, number one. Number two, one also has to be able to handle the philosophical issues that are raised by virtue of the study of Bereshit, which dovetails, which overlaps the fields of science, and therefore one should also have a PhD in the field of science. These are the three elements that are necessary to teach this class. Now, A, I do have, good to see you, welcome, long time, Baruch Haba. I do have a semicha that emphasizes both Talmud, codes, as well as Torah literature and Parshanut. I do have a PhD in philosophy, so therefore I do have 2/3 of what you really need. But in terms of the third component, I don't have a PhD in any area of science. Rather, all I have is biology, physics, and chemistry in high school, biology in college, and I lived for a year with a PhD in biochemistry from MIT, when I was a graduate student. And Michael Weiss and I have many discussions about what science and religion are all about. And I've read widely in the field. I do have a grasp of the issues. On the other hand, I still only have a grasp on 1/2 of what there really is all about in terms of these issues. On the other hand, I have taught this material to scientists, to engineers, to PhDs in math, and they all seem to be comfortable with my level of knowledge. I don't think I have the appropriate level of knowledge, but nevertheless, one should be very much aware of one's limitations when one engages. So I am aware of my limitations, and ultimately you will decide how critically important all these limitations are. That's point number one. Any questions about point number one? Good. Point number two. I am thrilled that you're all here, mainly because I believe that which we are about to engage in, the study of Torah Umada, or Torah and science, is one that is critically important to one's religious development. We're going to enter into the realm this week and the next few weeks, which I would say to you is the most significant realm in Jewish teaching or Jewish learning, at least according to some Jewish thinkers, not all. We're going to enter into the realm of what I'm going to call Da'at Elohim, which means knowledge of God. The study of science is a study of not of God's essence, that all acknowledge, all are aware, all agree, cannot be known by limited, finite human beings. Lo yidani Adam v'chai is the way that Borei Olam expresses it to Moshe Rabbeinu in the book of Shemot. But at least it's the study of, perhaps one might say, God's mind, as Stephen Hawking said, put it in one context or other, or God's will, as He created the world. At the very least, in studying science, you're going to understand what God's creation is all about. And thereby, one will be able to approach God from a certain perspective because one understands God's world. Or put differently, I would say to you that there are three elements, at the minimum, there are three elements that one should be aware of as far as Jewish life is all about. Well, Jewish life is concerned or what it's really all about. Number one is Yirat Shamayim. As a Jew, one wants to have a very strong and healthy sense of fear of heaven. Yirat Shamayim, or perhaps fear better expressed as awe of heaven, or having a sense of the overwhelming nature of who God really is, though it's a flawed understanding of who God really is. Besides Yirat Shamayim, one also wants to have a very profound sense of how to do the mitzvot. Practical elements of living as a Jew involve a fine sense, an important sense, a profound sense of how to do mitzvot, not only obviously as what's known as mitzvah melumada, which means a mitzvah simply just do, but rather one wants to understand the mitzvot externally and internally. By that I mean a distinction that Rabbi Soloveitchik, who I studied with for a number of years, made between certain mitzvot, where you have what we call ma'aseh mitzvah, which means you do the actual mitzvah itself, and that is what's called the kiyum mitzvah. Kiyum is the ultimate fulfillment of that mitzvah. Not every mitzvah can be fulfilled properly by simply ma'aseh mitzvah, by doing the mitzvah, but rather to fulfill the mitzvah properly, you need kiyum mitzvah. As for example, in prayer. Prayer is a very major category of Jewish living. In prayer, one can simply just pray. Put on tefillin, wrap your wraps, say the Shema Amidah, and unwrap your wraps, and you've prayed. You've done ma'aseh mitzvah. But have you indeed fulfilled what we know as kiyum mitzvah? The answer is no. What Soloveitchik will teach, that in order to accomplish kiyum mitzvah, you need to have as well, what?
Kavanah.
Kavanah, not good enough? What else but you have?
Understanding what you're saying.
Not good enough, correct, but not good enough. Intention, not good enough.
Your heart.
Sorry?
Your lips.
A heart as well, but beyond the heart, correct, it's what the heart leads to, is an awareness. An awareness of standing before Borea Olam and your Amidah. Not all people who pray have that fundamental awareness. Or, for many years, I tried to say the Shema properly. Six little words of saying Shema properly. And philosophically, it's the most extraordinary statement that one can say about God. The oneness, the aloneness, the onlyness, the uniqueness of God. And as I'm fond of saying and teaching, it's not only that God, Ehad, is unique, but rather, some of you should know this. Have you been? Nope. Not only is God unique, but rather...
Exclusive?
No. Yes, but more than that, God's uniqueness is unique. What's meistus? What does that mean? What it means is that if I have a unique watch, that only I have this extraordinary 298 creation, right? That's all I have. And you have a unique tie. Then my watch is unique and your tie is unique. But what do they have in common? They're both unique. They share a category called uniqueness. They both are unique. However, our assertion in the Shema is what? That God's uniqueness is, in fact, unique. So therefore, there's nothing to which one can analogize God to. God's uniqueness is unique. Ehad means unique, alone, oneness, all that. That's what the Shema means. Those six words are very powerful words that go to the very heart and essence of religion, even though they don't fully express exactly what God is, because one cannot express, one cannot understand exactly what God is. There's nothing to which we can analogize, and therefore God remains above, thank you, above and beyond all human comprehension. So this is an obvious point. However, Rabbi Soloveitchik says also that in the statement of the Shema, the Ma'aseh Mitzvah would be the recitation of those six words and the comprehension of those six words, as just discussed. However, one must go beyond that. Kiyum HaMitzvah of saying the Shema is what? It's a hard question. What is the full kiyum? Maaseh is saying the words. What's the kiyum? Kiyum of saying the Shema is the Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shemayim. It's not enough to proclaim God as Ehad, as one, alone, unique, singular, etc. But rather, one must also, to fulfill the mitzvah of Shema, is do the kiyum mitzvah, which is Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shemayim, meaning that I'm aware of you, of God, as one, alone, unique, etc. But more than that, I accept upon myself your commandments. So the saying of the Shema involves those two elements. Ma'aseh mitzvah, kiyum mitzvah. Third example, to understand a mitzvah properly. Let's say bar minan, God forbid, somebody in situation of mourning, avilut. So what one does as an avil is that one tears one's clothes. That's mitzvah. I said that one should feel the mourning, you tear your clothes. That's ma'aseh mitzvah. You've done what you had to do. What's the kiyum mitzvah of that? Feeling pain of the loss of somebody that you loved. What's the nafkamina? Where does that make a distinction? Let's say I don't like the person that passed away. It was my, who knows who. Let's say it was your sibling or your parent who abused you in one way or another. So you're happy they went to the next world. So but you go through the formal ma'aseh mitzvah of tearing your clothes, but there's no kiyum mitzvah because you don't feel the agony of losing that person. To do the mitzvah of elud properly, one must express and do ma'aseh mitzvah, but also kiyum mitzvah, which is feeling the agony of losing somebody special and unique. So every mitzvah, or most mitzvot, have those two elements to them. Ma'aseh mitzvah and kiyum ha-mitzvah. So when I say to you that in Jewish living there are three elements, they're not very simple elements. Yirat Shamayim is not very simple. I'm not going to explain what it is right now. But standing in awe of heaven is not very simple. That's point number one. As well as ma'aseh mitzvah, there's doing mitzvot. But the third element, the third area, is what we are calling Da'at Elohim, or knowledge of God. Somebody called me up 1 year ago. He says, I want to switch my child from one yeshiva in Deal to another yeshiva in Deal, to Hillel. Should I do this or not do this? This was his question to me. My answer is, it's a long period of thought. What are your goals for your child? I want to be a good Jew. How do you define being a good Jew? So he said, Yirat Shamayim, to do mitzvot. I said, great. Then let him stay where he is. It was a yeshiva, if you know where my synagogue is, which I refer to as across the tracks. Got the point? You didn't get the point? I will not be more explicit. We're on tape. It was a yeshiva. Now, that's very relative. If anybody asks, I say, well, all of reality is relative, as Einstein taught, right? It's all relative. Right? Relative. So, therefore, it's wherever you have to be. It's the other side of the tracks. But, okay. So, therefore, I said, however, if you want your child to achieve Da'at Elohim, he will never achieve that in the yeshiva that he's in. He will absolutely acquire Yirat Shamayim, which he won't get so much at Hillel. He will absolutely get Ma'aseh Mitzvot, an understanding, though not a profound understanding, but he will be committed to doing the Mitzvot, which is a Ma'ala as well, which is important as well. But I am guaranteeing he will not achieve Da'at Elohim. Now if you go to Hillel, you're not guaranteed Da'at Elohim either. Number one is you have models of people there, as Rabbi Tal, for example, who has achieved a measure of Da'at Elohim. And hopefully that won't embarrass him, nor will it deny who he really is. I think he has achieved Da'at Elohim there. And other teachers as well who have achieved all of this. Da'at Elohim, Yirat Shamayim, and of course Ma'aseh Mitzvot. Now it's not guaranteed that Hillel, in that you must go beyond, obviously, Hillel High School to achieve Da'at Elohim. It's not good enough to simply just go to Hillel High School. 12 years gets you a certain place, but you'll get the tools at Hillel to ultimately achieve Da'at Elohim if you go on to get your PhDs and whatever else you need to get in order to achieve Da'at Elohim. So what we are engaged in tonight and the following weeks is going to be Da'at Elohim, and we're going to do that through the study of science. Now, there are Jewish philosophers who will say that Da'at Elohim is the ultimate goal to which you should strive. It is the ultimate essence of being a Jew. Whom am I referring to? Harambam. Good, good. Must be attending Rabbi Kinnery's class, I hope. Well, maybe you don't need it then. I don't know. One or the other. Very good. Haramban, of course, is the primary source where the ultimate end and the ultimate idea of a Jew is to achieve Da'at Elokim, and therein you find immortality as well. To the extent that you have understanding of God, or to the extent that you achieve different levels of immortality. But it's not only Haramban. Any other suggestions? Will any of the medieval rationalists, Sa'adja Gaon, of course, to a certain measure, would say the same? Certainly, Ibn Bahya in Nachot Levot would say the same. Ibn Ezra would say the same, as well as one lesser known, is in Emunah Ramah. So all of these works would, in fact, adopt the position that I'm taking this evening. Now, of course, it is true that many Jewish thinkers would not adopt this position and would not say that you have to achieve Da'at Elokim in order to achieve the essence of Judaism. But I am saying that, in fact, it is the case that at least, at the very minimum, these thinkers will say what we're saying today, is that we want to achieve Da'at Elokim, and that in order to achieve Da'at Elokim, one must study the natural sciences. Especially, one would say, today. Especially today, where science and religion are re-converging. Where's Maharish Tabish?
Not here.
Supposed to be here. Okay, this is from his article, right? So you want to see it. But we want to thank him for sharing it with us. And you will tell him, thank you. He told me he was going to be here, but he's not. And you will see how what's amazing, what's utterly incredible, is that right now the pathway to understanding God is not only through Torah itself, through God's words, but also through God's deed. And what is the ultimate deed of God? Creation. So if one were to study creation, Maaseh Bereshit, then one would come to a knowledge, not of God's essence, agreed, but somewhat of God's will and of God's wisdom. Of God's wisdom. And that is the essential position of Sa'adja, Ibn Bahya, Haramban, Ibn Ezra. All of these thinkers wanted us better. Saw it as a religious obligation. You must study science to achieve Da'at Elokim. You have no choice but to study Maaseh Bereshit, physics, chemistry, biology, psychology, studying the disciplines in order to achieve an understanding of God. They were not afraid of any negative consequences. There are many who would say that if you study science, you're going to enter into a realm that can be very dangerous. Certainly there are risks. However, they would say that the only way of achieving this ultimate Da'at Elokim is through a study of science with all the possible consequences. So ultimately what you're going to see is that it becomes a religious obligation to study science. Not something that you just choose to do as a profession or whatever. No, we're saying over here that it becomes a religious obligation, hovadatit, to study science. One cannot become a fully religious Jew without the study of science, from the point of view of Sa'adja, Ibn Bahya, Rambam, Ibn Ezra, and a few others. Now, let's look a little bit at some of the sources that are going to justify that which we're doing. I am, in engaging in this right now, anticipating the challenge to why are you doing this? Why are you studying science and Bereshit whatsoever? Now, that may or may not be an issue in Brooklyn. It certainly is an issue in Deal. You cannot do what we are doing and publicly announce it without getting some extraordinarily intense negative feedback. That's Deal.
Are you doing it in Brooklyn?
That's what we're doing in Brooklyn. Or I do it in Deal under the table. I don't tell everybody I'm doing Deal, but I do the same thing in Deal. But nobody knows it. Yes, but nobody knows about it in Deal except for invitation. We're doing it for about four or five years we've been doing it, but only doing it without telling anybody. Because in Deal it becomes a very serious religious question and challenge. And it's better not to have to engage with those who challenge us. So, in order to justify and legitimize this pursuit of Da'at Elokim, which has to come via a study of the sciences, we're going to study some of the works of Haramban. Yes?
Why would those who oppose you
here, not oppose you in the halachic process where they know that the Torah is not complete and needs to be extended in the Torah Sheba'al Peh. So why wouldn't they say the same thing about Ma'aseh Bereshit and Soim, where it needs to be expanded? Because I'm assuming that those people would say, all we need to know about Ma'aseh Bereshit is there in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they would agree that all we need to know about Halakha is not there in the Torah and needs to be expanded upon.
Many of the people that will challenge that which we're doing are just simply ignorant of your point, and they are so fearful of engaging in it that they will just simply close the door without even pursuing it.
They're ignorant of the idea that halakha is not complete via the Torah.
No, Torah Shebaktat, Torah Shebaal Peh. So they will accept your study, perhaps, of studying science, in quotes, through the Torah and through Torah Shebaal Peh, but not science as you and I understand the word science. They will not open up a chemistry textbook.
They would accept whatever science might be presented in the Gemara, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and be willing to go...
You read an article 2 weeks ago which says that, which I don't want to talk about, because Emma said you cannot talk about this. But there was an article two weeks ago, which I never read that other publication ever, but it was there. So that's exactly one position that was stated. Sorry? That's my fault or his, I don't know. But hopefully you don't walk away with the conclusions from this as I walk away from his. Hopefully you don't. So when you contrast what we're going to do, what he did over there, you'll see hopefully a world of a difference. And what we're going to do ultimately, not this week but probably next week, is lay out the positions. That means you're going to find a spectrum of opinion throughout Jewish thought as to the legitimacy, ranging from the illegitimacy of what we're doing, all the way to the mitzvot aset, you must do what we're doing. You're going to find all of those and 4 or 5 in between positions as well. And at the end, hopefully you'll be able to characterize and categorize. What was the Ramban's position on science and religion? What was the Rambam's position on science and religion? What was the Sa'adi? What was Rabbeinu Bahya? All of that down the road we will hopefully express in order to show the legitimacy of what we are doing. Okay? So now let's look a little bit closer at our sources in order to legitimize, to engage in that which we're doing. First we're going to look at, and I made a few copies, sorry I didn't make enough, but I never do. So give those out and share them. This is from Sefer Mitzvot of Harambam. And again, I could multiply my sources with Sa'adja, with Rabbeinu Bahya, with Ibn Ezra, but I thought the Rambam was the clearest expression of that which we're doing. Let me reiterate. To be a Jew, from this point of view, there are 3 elements. First of all, there is Yirat Shamayim. Second of all, there is Ma'aseh HaMitzvah, to do a mitzvot, which we discussed and explained. And third of all, there's Da'at Elohim. To achieve Da'at Elohim, I am maintaining, one needs to study science. One needs to study both the word and the deed of the Creator. The word of the Creator is the Torah itself. But many of what we're going to see, many of those opinions and thoughts, are going to say that Torah, which David pointed out before, is a good source of Da'at Elohim, but not the ultimate source, not the truest source. It's along the lines of, one might say that one should believe in God. Got it. Good idea. Believe in God. The medievals, the Rashis, the Rambam, and Sa'adj, and all the others that we mentioned, will say, what is the belief in God? You might answer, it's the mouthing, I believe in God. Would they accept that? No, that's absolutely not. You must understand the content of your belief. What is your belief in God all about? And then they would go steps further and say, well, I can get some idea through tradition, but that's fallible. What is infallible from a medieval point of view? If I prove it, I must prove God's existence, and if I'm able to prove God's existence, then I'd be able to believe in that, what I know to be, once I've proven it. And they had their medieval proofs for God's existence. So, therefore, Da'at Elohim can only be achieved by engaging in the scientific inquiry in A, proving God's existence, and learning about God from His deeds. from his world that he created, which is physics, chemistry, biology, etc. Good. Everybody has a source. This is the mitzvah of the Rambam, the third mitzvah, right? The first mitzvah, of course, is to believe in God, or to knowing that God exists. One can only know through your scientific or philosophical proofs. Hence my statement from the very beginning that one needs to have a PhD in philosophy in order to deal with some of these issues. That was first. Second commandment is to believe in the oneness or aloneness of God, which is the Shema. Good. And the third commandment in the Rambam's list is Mitzvah Gimel, Hi Shivano Bavato Yit Aleh. You must love God. Now, to love God, what would follow up on that? What if I want to love God, what is my next step?
Knowing
God. I cannot love that which I don't know. Obvious point. I cannot love that which I don't know. So therefore, I must know God in order to love God. So how do I come to know God? His commandments. We spoke about the mitzvot. His statements. That's the Torah. Correct? Upe'olotav. What does the word pe'olah mean?
Creation.
What he did. That is the ultimate pe'olah of God, is creation. So therefore, I must think about and comprehend his mitzvot, umamarav, pe'olotav. Now, achinasigeo, until we comprehend him, and enjoy intellectual comprehension, this pleasure in comprehension. So enjoy the comprehension of God. This is the obligation. This is the mitzvah. I say you must love God. To love God, I must know God. What's the pasuk involved over here? We have to, and love the Lord your God. How am I going to love God? How do I know how to love God? These words, Talmud Torah, that I command you to say, on your heart, from studying his words, you'll recognize he who created the world. Now, medievally, what organ of the human body was the organ of thought?
The heart.
The heart, exactly. The heart. So it's...
I thought it was, the heart was feeling.
Moderns think heart feels. Medieval context, the heart was the organ of thought. So he says, on your heart is to think about all these issues. Harambam's purely rational approach was that through the Torah and through the natural world, you will come to an awareness of God, a knowledge of God, and ultimately a love of God. So you must study science to know God. It's Pe'olot Hashem, to know God, and therefore come to a love of God. Are you committed to love God? Absolutely. What's the pasuk? Ve'ahavta shorokecha. Right? Are there other pesukim that the Rambam could have quoted about knowledge of God? Multiple pesukim. Just simply take a korkadot out and look up where it says, Atah uret hayom la da'at, to know, Keshem Elokim. Or Yirmiyahu Perek Tet says, right? Haskel yadol alti, coming to know me. So many of the medievals, rationalists, will use multiple pesukim to bring you to the awareness that you must know God. And the only way to know God is to prove his existence, which they did. And when you prove God's existence, you come to know that God exists, and you'll study his attributes, not his essence. You'll never know God's essence, but his attributes from his ma'amarav, from his zuzat, and from his pe'olotav. And then ultimately you will come to love God by knowing God. When you know, you will come to love. Right? And then you have the pleasure of loving God. Okay, that's the first point. Now, the next point, similar to this, will be Harambam's Hilchot Teshuvah, where he talks about a similar issue. How do you come to love God? Now, what's the reason that I bring to you first Sefer HaMitzvot and then Hilchot Teshuvah? How do these two Maimonidean sources differ? Well, one may have argued that Sefer HaMitzvot is not a halakha l'maaseh source. That we must find the same exact information in the Mishneh Torah, which is Psak Halakha. So it's interesting that the Rambam would take that same exact source and of course incorporate it into his halachic practicum. That when you want to do Judaism, part of the mitzvot that you have to do is to incorporate Da'at Elohim. So take note how my original categorization of a threefold essence of being Jewish, which is Yirat Shamayim, Maaseh HaMitzvot, and Da'at Elohim, actually overlap. You will find, obviously, references to all three in the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. Not necessarily so in the Hilchot Shulchan Aruch. If you get Shulchan Aruch and Bishul Kairo, you will not find all these so clearly characterized in his halachic work. But Haramban, certainly you will. You will find all of these three elements as part and parcel of a Jew's halachic obligations. So therefore it becomes obvious that Da'at Elohim is part and parcel of a Jew's halachic obligation. Not only for the philosophers amongst us, but also from the average Jewish person has to also strive to achieve Da'at Elohim. So let's look at Hilchot Teshuvah chapter 10. It's halacha 6, end of the page. Davar yadu barur. It's obvious, known to all. She'en ahavat HaKadosh Baruch Hu nikshered b'libo shel adam ad she'yishge bat hamikaroi. Number one, you cannot love the Almighty till you are constantly involved in the object of your love, namely ongoing intellectual or at least emotional first attachment to God. Yazov kol mash ba'olam chutz mimena. Look at the stats the Ram wants you to achieve. Leave all aside except for love of God. As it says, Basuk, with all of your heart and all of your soul. So Ram takes this very literally. In order for you to ultimately come to a love of God, you must abandon all else, and you must love God all your heart and all your soul. Right? Unlike the way that the Midrash understands Chod Nafshecha, which is what? Yeah, they're much easier. The Midrash says that only love God all your soul means if it happens to be that you're waiting to be martyred, then do it. If you face the Romans, right? You're living in the Roman Empire, and they want you to martyr, as an example of Rabbi Akiva, then you must do it. Love God except where you're willing to give up your soul, your life for God. Rabbi wants much more than that. He doesn't want you to only give up your soul. He wants you to be intensely involved and concerned in love with God. Overwhelmingly so. What biblical book would be the best example for Haramban? Shir HaShirim. Intense love that one should feel for God. But most of you are saying, but God's an abstraction. How do I love God? What's an abstraction? What's the answer? Study His works. His deed and His works. His works, Torah, study that, study his deed, come to know what the attributes of God are all about, and you will then come to love God. Now, when the Rambam says abandon all else, does he mean abandon all else? No. What does he really mean? As he explains in Moreh Nevuchim, the forefathers of Isaac, Yaakov, Moshe were all fully engaged in the world about them. How do I know that? The stories of Bereshit. And that's what Bereshit tells me, they were involved in sheep and in wealth and negotiating treaties, Avimelech, Paro, all kinds of stuff, right? Good. But ultimately they achieved this love of God, where their minds and hearts and souls were attached to the above as they engaged in trivial pursuits of this life. Women do this all the time. Women have this amazing ability, men do it also, but women do it all the time, where they're able to do five things at once, all equally well. They're taking care of their kids, they're changing diapers, they're doing, and they're making supper, and they're answering the phones, and they're playing Mahjong. Multitask. Multitask, right. All right, right? Do I know women well?
Women do it better than men.
Than men, right.
Oh, when I explained it, that's what Nashim Da'atan Kalot means.
Oh, is that so? I don't want you to say that here now.
That's what he says, that Nashim Da'atan Kalot means...
You're able to.
They're able to flip, to go from one...
Okay, good. Oh, good. I didn't hear that. Yeah. Good. That sounds... Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Victor said in order to make his wife happy. And very wise on Victor's part. Very sharp. That'd be Victor. Okay, so multitask is a way to phrase it. And again, well, I suppose men can do it. Maybe women can do it better. But there is something to be said for that. To be able to focus on one task and do it, and at the same time do another task as well. Harambam analogously wants you to achieve the same kind of engagement. Same kind of engagement where your mind and heart and soul could be fully engaged in seeking, understanding, and knowing God, as you're able to engage in the trivial pursuits, you're doing other things. I mean, obviously, you're able to eat dinner while watching television. Many people do that. And many men argue with their wives while they're reading the newspaper. Right? They're able to do those both really well. And my counseling sessions, I advise against doing that. So don't take that as a serious example. But men do that. So the point over here is Haramban wants you to engage intellectually with God while you are functioning. There are people in shul that I once did something terrible about. I was speaking, they were reading something else. So I was very personally insulted. I thought that was rude. I am speaking, I put 4 hours to writing the speech, and you're reading something else. So I approached the person, and he says, I can do two things at one time. I said, okay. I was going to quiz it, but I was embarrassed to. So he's my teacher in third grade, actually. He's about double my age, so I figured I'm not going to do that. But that's what I should have done. Now, the question is, when I take up the New York Times and I look like this, I said, at least put it under the chair, under the table, because it gets very embarrassing. Other people watch you, they see you, and not everybody can do two things at one time. But he could. So I assume he understood whatever I said, and he's well able to read, and he could do two things at one time. And it's even more interesting is he'll pray the Amidah reading another book.
Wow.
No, he does. He'll read a book and he's praying the Amidah. He does it. You don't like that one. Okay. In any case, so that's what Haramban wants of us, to be fully engaged in Ahavat Hashem, to love God. Now, how do you come to that great level of love of God? Only with knowledge. The only way that one can ultimately come to love God is through da'at, is through knowledge. Shida'ehu, to know God. And according to the level of divine knowledge that you achieve, according to the level of understanding about God that you achieve, that's the degree of love. Minimally, in me'at, me'at. Less knowledge of God, less love of God. Harbe, harbe. If you are able to achieve great knowledge of God through a great study of the Sakh, you'll see in a moment. Therefore, Haramban wants you, notice the terms that he uses. Therefore, a person has to isolate himself, to understand, to become wise. What does the word hokhmot mean? Chokhmah, what's chokhmah? With the wisdoms, or the one can use the word scientific pursuits, utvunot, hamodiot lo et kono, those which bring to you knowledge of your Creator, the sciences. And we'll get back to this point in 1 minute. Kifi koach shiesh ba'adam, according to the level of understanding the person has, le'avin, to understand, le'asig, to acquire, kemo shebe'an v'chodesh de'at Torah. So now, the Ram tells us, as I explain to Israel Torah. Now, I don't think my secretary actually... I'm going to get to it right this second. Okay, don't worry. Now, Haramban also, she didn't make the next copy. I apologize for that. But the next copy is, we now went to the next reference of Haramban, as he told you to go. So we go. It's in Perek Sheni, Halakha Aleph and Bet. Haramban tells you, Ha'el ha'nechbad. I'm sorry that I didn't xerox it for you. Ha'el ha'nechbad. God who is honor, worthy of honor and awesome. It's a commandment to love God, as we've seen, and to stand in awe of God. As the verse says, love God. And the verse says, shiloke chatzidah, stand in awe of God. So your next question is, how do you come to love and fear God? So now take note of his next words. Misha'ah, at the moment, shitbonen, when he comprehends, person. Vima'asav, the deeds of God and what he creates. The awesome creations of God. Nitzalim ha'gidolim. V'remehem ochotu, and he sees God's great wisdom. She'en la'erech en la'oketz. So it has no end to the infinite wisdom of God. What's going to be your feeling? Interesting is that intellectually, you will come to feel the emotion called love. Now, awe and love. Hold on for a minute. Does that ring true to you? Have you ever been engaged intellectually in a pursuit where you came to love that pursuit? Well, if you ever were involved in something that was very intellectually taxing, let's say you're involved in a PhD program in any field, it's intellectually involving. It's an 18 to 20 hour per day pursuit when you're heavily involved in it. And you come at a certain point to do what? To love your field, in quotes. I just thought that was fascinating. You're involved intellectually. You're reading, you're writing, you're thinking, you're analyzing. And what do you come to? Loving your field. I love my field. I love doing what I do. I don't mean my profession. That's a different story. Love being a rabbi or not. That's a different kind of a love, I guess you'd call it. But my field per se is a passion of mine. I will spend hours upon it. There was a period of time when I was fully engaged that I spent much more time with Maimonides and his son than I did with my wife and my daughter when she was first born. It was just you walk into a room, you close the door, and you're hour upon hour just engaged in your work. You loved your field. I loved it. And it's not true only of me, it's true of all my fellow graduate students. Just engage ongoingly in this pursuit. Not simply, 5 days, it was 7 days a week. Any moment you had, you want to read more. And I still have that same feeling, which is very nice. I mean, 30 years later, I have the same love of reading and rereading all that I had read 25 and 30 years ago. So you love your field. So I'm telling you over here that when you think about God's creation, right? Imagine this. One good example of this would be, if you ever want to see the excitement of somebody who loves his field, ask Dr. Marshama about the eye. Not the hand, the eye. He's an ophthalmologist. And he once spoke in shul about the eye. For an hour and a half, and he was just flying way above everybody else. The rods, the neurons, the color perception, the depth, and how it's developed. Extraordinary. He loves the eye. He loves his field. So that's a great example of that. It is good. He did my eyes. He operated. Anybody that loves his field that way, you could operate anytime you want in my eyes. So that was fine. So, and my mom tells you, when you love God's creation, and you see God's great wisdom, she'ena edef elokes, right? Speak to somebody. A friend of mine just had a kidney transplant. Right? Person very friendly with. Went to visit him. Says, you can't imagine what the kidney's all about. Okay. He told me. For 25 minutes, he told me. It does this. So then you don't appreciate it. I didn't get a new one. So I didn't. He's right. He got a new one. And he's so thrilled. So overwhelming. When you see the human body and how it works. And if we have the time, we are going to discuss a little bit about some of these issues. Not as much in the biological realm, but in the physical realm, which is more of an interest of mine, but we'll see. That when you think about how all this actually works, and you see the infinite wisdom of God in creating the universe, as we will speak about in a few minutes, 1 second please, you're going to leave the realm of pure intellect and enter into the realm of love. Miyat hu'ohev. Now again, I guess it's true that if you've never experienced it, it's hard to express it. But if you have experienced it, going from the purely intellectual to the feeling of loving your field, it's true. You love and you praise and you glorify. And more interesting is the next verse of the Rambam. You will have this great insatiable feeling of wanting to know God. When you see God's creation and you study all that He created in the universe and in the biology of the human being, you will have this great desire to come lida, to know God. As David said, interesting exegesis of this pasuk, my soul thirsteth for God, the living God. David HaMelech had this thirsting for God. Harambam uses this pasuk to express the love that a person will have, this great emotional ta'ava, almost physical desire to know God. Notice how the realm of the intellectual and the emotional overlap over here. Now, what happens next? When you think about these issues of the world, what's going to happen? You're going to all of a sudden be stopped dead in your tracks and proceed backwards. Because you're going to feel that sense of awe and fear. Two words. Yir'ah is awe. Pahad is fear. Yir'ah doth yir'had. He will feel both awe of God's creation and fear. Pahad. Both. V'yodea shehu b'riyah ketana. And he will come to this awareness that he is simply a very small, tiny creature. As you will see in a few moments. Shefila fila. You are nobody. Or may b'dat kala. Who am I to even think that I could understand or know God? You're standing b'dat kala with, as a simple-minded person, in front of He who is all, knowledge of all, and you're almost at this point entering into the realm of mysticism, which is surprising to say. Surprising to say that the purely intellectual can ultimately end up into the realm of the mystic. But it's true. The Rambam in Moreno Bukhim, part 3, chapter 51, does in fact enter into the realm of the mystical, one would say. Which is a fairly obvious point. The Ben Avraham, the Rambam's son, was very much of a mystic ascetic. Rabbi Avraham, the Rambam's son, was very much that, where Rabbi Avraham had taken some of the themes of Harambam and developed them a little bit further along the line and became a mystic in some sense. And therefore, there are those who want to explain that the Rambam really entered into this realm. It's not surprising. Harambam was very much influenced, as we all know, by Aristotelian philosophy, by Aristotle, but which is less well known by Neoplatonic philosophy as well. If one were to read Neoplatonic philosophy, you would see the connection between Neoplatonism and mysticism. I would say to you that one of the two, I would say, great religious experiences that I've ever had was in reading the Aeneids by Plotinus. Plotinus was one of the first of the great, known as a Neoplatonist, and he writes of the One, the absolute nature of the One, and how the One emanates into the, ultimately to this world. And you read that you're carried away from this purely intellectual description of the One, not the Matrix One. That's a shame that he used that term. I apologize for that. Of the capital One, and you read that and you see the attachment of that whole philosophy to Kabbalah, to mysticism. So from the purely intellectual, you end up in the realm of the mystic, to that which is beyond the mind. The Rambam will tell you that the mind only gets you so far, and then it's your intuitive leap which gets you beyond that. When you read the intellectual, you could end up with a mystical experience. So it would seem to be that the Rambam is saying something along those lines over here. That the person is intellectualizing, understanding the natural order. One more second. Okay, David, yes. You were very patient. And I'm a patient of yours, so I should be patient when you...
I have to credit my friend Gina Sinstein for bringing this up to us a few weeks ago. My problem is that the Rambam's science was fallacious. He relied on an Aristotelian concept of the universe that was outdated, is outdated today by as long as he's dead, 1,000 years. Now, but he still seems to be convinced in Mishneh Torah, and I guess in the Moreh Agah, that he is on the path to achieving the knowledge of God. But if his science is fallacious, then what does that say about the knowledge that he has of God? And we have to question whatever knowledge we might achieve through the study of science, because we know that in 100 years, our science will probably be outdated. Now,
maybe.
This is almost the flip side of the question that I asked earlier.
Right. Yeah, I expect that from you.
But so yeah, hypocrisy is my middle name. So what I'm trying to get here, my question really is, then this is only really an attempt. It can never really be achieved.
Right. That's a very important point. First of all, Harambam's science may have been flawed, but it's irrelevant because the model of the man of science who wants to go from the realm of physics to the realm of metaphysics. Physics is the world that you and I inhabit, the physical world. However, behind the physical world is the metaphysical. Meta is the Greek alphabet is that which comes beyond physical. So you want to know the metaphysical world. So you achieve metaphysics, Harambam will tell you, through a study of physics. So physics goes to metaphysics. Right? Number one. So now what I'm telling you to do now is that when you study physics in the contemporary mode, you will come to that great, wonderful understanding of the metaphysical world. You'll come to Da Elokim. So ultimately what you're saying to me,
we have to acknowledge that our knowledge is not complete.
Okay, good. Okay, hold on just one second. Okay, good, absolutely correct.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. The process is what you want to engage in. Having made the point in the very beginning that even though when you study the physical world, which is limited ultimately, therefore your knowledge of God will ultimately be limited, you will never come to a knowledge of the essence of God. But the process of coming to know God is really what you want to achieve, and which is why that the book of Shemot tells you that you can never name God. When you name, you can define. You can label. This is God. This is David Azar. I know David Azar. We all know David Azar because we know the name of David Azar. Right? However, the name of God remains, book of Shemot, inexpressible, inexplicable. We can never know and therefore define ultimately God. So the essence of God remains unknown. Ultimately, in all, both Christian, Jewish, and Islamic philosophy in the Middle Ages, everybody agrees that the essence of God can never be known. All the more so because the world is only finite, so it's a stretch to go from the finite to the infinite. So I can only get to God's will or wisdom, perhaps. But again, here with the Rambam, I'm using the Rambam and Sa'adja, Rabbi Bahi, and again, I can find sources for all these for you, that the model is, you want to ultimately achieve as a religious obligation, Da'at Elohim. And to do that, one studies science. One studies the creation of God. Going one step further, in a minute.
Ben. Also, just on his point, which are about science, is basically, I would say about 70% of science is observation. And even if his conclusions based on his observation was wrong, his observations are exactly the same observations we're making today. And just those observations alone is enough to give you an immense love for God. You watch, talk about people out, you know, just looking at the sunset or the sunrise, and they say it's so beautiful and so awe-inspiring. They look at the sky. Even if they don't understand it at all, the observation is enough. And Rambam,
I don't think it would have been better. So Rambam was here. I think the Rambam would
want to
know how the atom works,
okay,
how the subatomic
works.
Oh, absolutely.
Want to know.
I wouldn't be satisfied with the observation. And I won't be satisfied with
it. No, the observation and the process of trying to get to understand it and know the details about it and how it works.
I think the rabbi's answer was very satisfying, that we have to acknowledge that as hard as we may want to live by this idea, it's limited, it's finite, and it can never really be, but it's still the goal. It still should be our goal. But our goal is not to not true Da'at Elohim, but it's just to strive for Da'at Elohim.
Right, absolutely. Now, one or two more points. Yes, Jeff?
Well, as long as everybody's sort of part right, David is too, then. Exactly. The idea was that Maimonides, he reached to a point that he couldn't understand in physics. And at that point, 1,000 years ago, then after that, then he can't understand the sunrise. He can't understand gravity. He can't understand it. So then it goes to something that's unknowable. Unknown is mystery. That's where mystic comes from. Mystery comes. It's unknown. To know that is so. It has to be a leap. We're in a different stage right now. Certainly, we don't know everything either. However, it's from that point of now. I don't know anymore. I can't know anymore. And now I have to go to something else.
The interesting point here is Dr. Faustus. In the Christian tradition that goes back many, many years prior to Dr. Faustus, Dr. Faustus, is that there's a prohibition of trying to know more. And you must sell your soul to the devil to achieve that ultimate knowledge. It's not a Jewish idea.
No, when there are some people that won't agree with that.
And that's true, too.
That's why you're in Brooklyn.
Okay, we'll leave that alone for a while.
One question to say, on fear. Why fear? Why is there fear in practice?
Good. The Rama may use both terms, so I think that's a good point that you're raising. When you study the world as it is and you come to a sense, to an understanding, look at the words of the Rambam. Miyad hu nirta' lahurav. You are taken aback. You come to this awareness of what God has created. You're shocked. It's an emotional reaction.
Amazement.
And then you're taken aback. Biira, biithad. You stand in awe and you'll be afraid of this extraordinary God that now you're standing in front of. This might not be a modern sensibility. You are a product of the modern world, and modern people are not, especially in America, are not taught to fear, to have fear of anything, especially of that of God. We don't fear God in that same way. We're afraid of God's punishment. How am I talking about that over here? How am I talking about over here? It's almost an instinctive fear of, if all of a sudden you were attacked by a lion in, let's see, living in Brooklyn, and right? And all of a sudden, on Avenue U, somebody just, and you would have that, all of a sudden, that spontaneous sense of
fear.
It's an awareness that my life is threatened now. So the Rambam is saying, when you think of God in this overwhelming sense, we think of God as El Rachum Hanun, of course we should. It's God's compassion, God's loving, God's caring. We see God in a much different way than how Rambam saw God. He sees God in a much more multifaceted, complex way.
Compared to when God was speaking at Mount Sinai, you know, that time.
Yeah.
Awe, fear.
It's a complex emotion. The power of God. Yeah. Yeah.
Fear.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. One second, Jack. Yeah,
so? So basically what we're saying here, from what I'm hearing from Joe, et cetera, is that the fact that we know so much more today, science, gravity, or other types of discipline, it's harder for us to go ahead to reach that jump to the spiritual state.
No, easier.
No, difficult, because there's less that's going to mystify us, the less that we're not going to...
No.
Whereas at Rambam is at a point where an apple falls from a tree, wow, that's an amazing thing, because he's not understanding the concepts of gravity.
Interesting.
For us now, we already understand how it falls and why it falls.
I will say absolutely wrong. I will not agree with that at all. Why? Because when you read about the true nature of the universe, which we will do, you'll see it's much more complicated. You'll say, more wow. You'll say, this is what God created. I can't believe it. So what inspired the Rambam was the apple falling down, or Newton, as the case may be, right? Either way, he'll say wow to that. Yes, you will not be overwhelmed, but actually you will be. In a few minutes, if we get there, you will see, you'll say a much louder wow, but your loud wow will be as loud as the realm's wow, though the data upon which you're basing your wow differs.
It's a more intellectual pursuit.
Not more intellectual. He engages his mind, it's just more, the data was different.
I think the more you know that you know less.
Absolutely, correct. Yeah, so we know more now. The Rambam did 1,000 times more than the Rambam did, but we know how much less we really know.
We don't know.
The fear that you're talking about is innate, because by then...
It's innate, it's a good word, innate.
Not having knowledge of God's, of nature, per se, meteors in the earth, or great catastrophes that happen upon earth, they fear God, that God brought it upon men.
Right, so they have to, right, correct.
Okay.
Right.
Having the understanding... Having the understanding of that today, the little really, how little do we know of anything, so the fear grows for people that really know of science, to the point to say, well, there's so much more out there.
Right, which we're going to cover. Right, we're going to cover that. Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
So we telescope.
Right, we'll come to that in a minute.
Made us very much aware of that.
Right.
I just want to say this, that the very fact that we don't know what is at the end of space.
Who doesn't know?
Whether there's a wall or what.
You come in 4 weeks, I'll tell you what's the end of space. 4 weeks, you got to come.
That's
what we're getting ready to hear 4 weeks in a row. Everybody, next will be half, and it's a third, and it'll end up much less. So the end, you'll tell us what's the end of space in 4 weeks.
Or inspiring.
Yes.
Don't
move. Yes, it's always fine. One last point as far as the Rambam is concerned, then I want to go to my next point. So all of that was regarding the study of science is going to bring you to a knowledge of God, a love of God, a fear of God. This is a religious obligation. It's chovat datit for us to know all this. And he quotes, of course, one of the most famous and one of the most wonderful of Pesukim, Tehillim Perek Chet, which I love to review and study, when David HaMelech says, Ki yireh shamecha, maaseh sefirotecha. When I see, David says, your heavens, the work of your fingers. When does the heaven look like lattice work like your fingers? At night, stars connected. What do I think immediately? What's a human being? Now, it's true that when Saul sees the heavens, he doesn't say, however, he will say that when we finish our discussion for tonight. When he sees the heavens and sees what's beyond the heavens, he will say that statement. And then what happens next? And you say, that man is less than divine. So in that one psalm, David captures the awe that you feel, the grandeur that you feel, all that makes the human being so wonderful. Right? So now, one last point over here. Harambam in the Chosh Torah Perek Dalet has this interesting statement. He talks about entering to this realm of science and then going into the realm of metaphysics. Physics, for Rambam and for the medievals, is what's known as Ma'aseh Bereshit, is the physical world. Based on the Gemara Chagigah, chapter 2, Maaseh Bereshit. And the metaphysical world for the medievals is, that means God, and however God which stands behind the physical world is metaphysics, which is Maaseh Merkava. That's called Pardes. And he quotes him, Gemara, that four great rabbis entered into this metaphysical world. Hayudah, the great rabbis. Not all of them were able to understand and comprehend all they had to comprehend. And therefore, what happened to the four rabbis that went into this metaphysical world? Tanabam tells you. Elisha ben Avia became a heretic. Danger. Ben Azai decided to stay on the other side of the metaphysical divide, and he, therefore, we call it died, but he just simply stayed on the other side out of his love for being on the other side with God. Then Zoma Yitzamidato, he lost his mind, so you might say that his mind stayed on the other side, where his soul returned over here. And Ona Biakiva, Nechnapsho Sabbat Shalom, he entered in peace and he exited with peace. So the Rama says, I omit, she'en alo taliyah for this. Not everybody could study metaphysics. Only when you are firmly rooted and mature enough with bread and meat. What is bread and meat?
Material things.
Right, right. When you're full with the halachot, with the Jewish law of lechem u'basar, le'edat, to know what's right, what's wrong. Rabbi Akiva is the founder of the halachic system. So therefore, he was able to enter metaphysically and ultimately to become rooted back here on earth. You need a very firm behavioral orientation so you don't lose your mind on the other side.
Didn't the other three have that?
They lost their mind, no.
But they didn't have that rooted.
Didn't have the same rootedness, exactly, right. So those three were affected very negatively by this experience. Sorry?
They probably thought they did.
They may have, but they obviously didn't. So they didn't. But only Rabbi Akiva, who had this rootedness, this psychological and emotional rootedness, was able to enter into the world of metaphysics and leave it. And what is that world of Lechem Basar? Hasud HaMutar. Purat Tefillin tomorrow morning. Wherever you travel metaphysically, what do you have to do when you get up tomorrow morning? Purat Tefillin. And pray. So to know what's prohibited, what's allowed. Now, what's more important? The civil law and the minutia of Talmudic law or Pardes? What's more important?
Simple.
Sorry?
Simple.
Most people would say that the minutia of mutar and asur is much more important.
For most people.
For most people. Rav makes the point over here. Of a pishtar and eil, these issues were called by the rabbis davar katan. Small stuff. Small potatoes, excuse the pun. Shalem rachamim. What's davar gadol? What's the great stuff? Maaseh merkava. What's the small stuff? Havayot v'rava. The arguments of the Talmud is small stuff. The big stuff is metaphysics. Maaseh merkava. Metaphysics.
Is that
Yecheskel? Yes, that's what it's rooted in. So even though one is small and one is great, obviously you have to first study the small stuff, the lech basar, the small potatoes, the Talmudic arguments, that's small, because they settle your mind. And ultimately you need to know the small stuff to have this world as it is, and it will ultimately achieve Olam Haba. Right? They have Shash Yidayim HaKol, and it's possible to know everything. Gadol V'Katan, Ish V'Isha, Ba'alev, Rahav, Ba'alev, Katsar. Everybody can ultimately know the small stuff. Only a few can know the metaphysics, which is based on the physical world. Metaphysics is about God, physics is about this world. So the Rambam obviously puts a great deal of stock in knowing the science. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, and Moreno Bochim and all those, he gives you the program, but what you, that you don't do that.
Does he believe he got the Maaseh Merkava?
Absolutely. Yeah, Rambam believed that he achieved it. I believe.
And Rabbi Akiva, according to him?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. You know, and many would agree with him. He has many statements throughout his works that he achieved prophecy, which would be the same equivalent of this. He had this great intellectual power. I mean, his mind was extraordinary, and he achieved that dat elokim, that attachment to the divine, carrying beyond the realm of the rational to the realm of the insightful. Again, anybody that's involved in a pursuit which takes a tremendous amount of intellectual energy has achieved that as well. That insight, you feel, I got it. It comes as a flash. And you feel, you grasp something, you know it, you understand it, you conceptualize it beyond the realm of the rational. That's the mystical, and then you feel the planet. Now,
are
so what?
Saying that most people should not go for the mystical.
You have to begin. Yeah, I'm saying that. He's saying that. You have to begin with lechem basar, with meat and bread, the small stuff. Study Talmud. Build yourself up to a study of the ultimate physics, and then metaphysics. Right? That's what he wants. Now, what we've concluded from all this is that the study of natural science is Da'at Elokim. Da'at Elokim is a supreme religious value. Admittedly, not all will agree with the statement, yet there are an array, of course, of Jewish thinkers. Hanabam is only one of many who support this notion. None can deny the Rambam and Sa'adja and Rabbeinu Bachya. All that the other side can say is that there are others, great Jewish personalities, that would disagree, obviously. But none can deny the power and stature of Sa'adja, Rabbeinu Bachya, Rambam, Reza, etc.
Do they disagree with it in its essence, or do they disagree with it
both.
In its application?
Both. Both. The answer is both. There are those who say that don't even enter to that realm. And there are good Talmudic sources, like Gemara Hariyah will say, to whom can you, who can study Ma'aseh B'Shem Seh Merkava? Whatever that meant in its original context. They'll say, you can't even study it. It's not meant. The first opening, the first Midrash, one of the first Midrashim in the book of Bereshit. Why does Torah start with a bet? And then the other letter. You should know this Midrash. It's a great Midrash. Why? You know what?
Right.
Exactly. Very good. The bed. Sorry. What school did you go to? All right. Okay. Good school. So that bed, the bed sheet, is closed. Only look ahead of you. Don't look up. Don't look beyond. What was that? The rabbis in that, but you didn't go to second grade. That was an anti-Gnostic polemic. The rabbis were arguing with the Gnostics, those who believed that knowledge was everything and that you should engage in all of that. And this was the rabbinic anti-Gnostic polemic against that movement, Jewish movement of the Gnostics, G-N-O-S, Gnosis, knowledge. So, yes, there's much in the Gemara and there's much in the Midrash which will tell you not to do all of this. So they will tell you, one cannot do all of this. Don't study anything other than Torah Mitzvot. Even the Rashi said, what should we have begun, first Rashi, what should we have begun the Torah with? Now with all this Bereshit business. Who needs all this Bereshit business? What do we need? Why? Don't do mitzvot. That she was of the mind that one is to only study the mitzvot, practical. And that she had Yirat Shamayim. And again, that is actually the model of Moshe Shivot. Moshe Shivot are going to study Yirat Shamayim, and they're going to study Maaseh Mitzvah, how to do a mitzvah properly. They're not going to engage in what we're calling Da'at Elokim. They deny that whole realm. Certainly from the right wing, that's true. The model of that, based on Rabbi Soloveitchik and others, which we're going to bring reference to next week, would say exactly the opposite. That one, as Hanabam would say, has a supreme religious obligation of studying science in order to ultimately come to Da'at Elokim. Now, what's interesting over here, ironically, is that anybody that's studied the history of science sees something really striking. Full circle. Early medieval science confirmed the worldview of the biblical Christians. Science supported the Christian worldview. It all worked out perfectly. What were the essential features of that? That the center of the universe is the earth, and man is the prime creation of God. Now, we traveled from that to the early modern period of Kepler, Copernicus, and finally Galileo, who ultimately challenged the Christian view of the world and had to recant at the pain of his life. He had to recant. So that began when the church used its power and its muscle to stop Galileo from saying what he wanted to say. For the next 200 years, science broke free. They had seen that the Ptolemaic view of the world was not right. The epicycles was not right. It doesn't work that way. And Kepler and Brahe all had seen a different view, that the orbits are not exactly circular. Why did that be circular? Because that was perfect. God makes perfect things. The circle is perfect. There's no beginning, no end. But they were not perfect. Mercury wasn't fitting into this whole orbit. They were more elliptical. So till Kepler observed it. Science is observation. So they observed it. And then till Brahe conceptualized it, and they all got it all together, science broke through the next 200 years from all of this. And then what took place was worlds antagonistic to each other. The scientific world and the Christian world were very much opposed to each other. Now what's happening is exactly the opposite. Now we're seeing a reconvergence. Mara Stavish, tell him thank you. A reconvergence of science and religion. To the extent where, was it 2 years ago, it's a great column by George Will on where science and religion converge. I tried to find it and bring it, but I couldn't find it, so I'll bring it if I find it next week. But you'll find books like God and the Big Bang. What's the Big Bang all about? Creation. Everybody's saying that now. Now it's almost become a dogma of science that the Big Bang is really about creation. Remember, up until the Hubble telescope, until as late as 1947, when somebody speculated about a Big Bang, he was laughed at, derided. By whom? By Hoyle. Who was Hoyle? One of the great astronomers, physicists of the 20th century. He's the one who coined the term Big Bang. He laughed at the idea. The universe is static, not dynamic. It's unchanging. It was infinite and eternally that. There was no creation, Hoyle said. Everybody agreed with him. Until 65, when Arnio Penzias, from New Jersey, as well as Wilson, discovered background radiation. What's it due to? Obviously from the original Big Bang of 12 billion years ago. God and the Big Bang, and now we're talking about discovering harmony between science and spirituality. And when you go to all the books, in the beginning by Aviez, it's a very poor book, I didn't like this book at all, but very, not good. This, all the way to this extraordinary book, The Physics of Immortality, thank you, where what is this about? Saying from an atheist, modern cosmology, God and resurrection of the dead. Where this is a student, Frank was a student of Stephen Hawking's, and says, I don't believe in God, but there has to be immortality. Goddamn 18. Shocking. This whole entire story. I mean, it's amazing. To that degree, where religion is now becoming confirmed by scientists. Not all. One wants to also, Skeptical Inquiry and the Inquirer is a very nice publication, all about skepticism. And they have a special issue on science and religion. You're going to find, we're going to find, all kinds of scientists who are confirming religion in the same moment where I'm going to talk about Steven Weinberg, who Harvard PhD and all that, who is an atheist and doesn't all make sense whatsoever. And you're even going to utilize one of my favorite books by George Greenstein, PhD, Stanford, Yale, brilliant mind, and he talks about the universe, how impossible the universe is without God, but I don't believe in God. He actually has a very immature understanding of God. He's a Christianized belief of God. So he can't accept God, because again, when you think about God in a small g, so to speak, which he does, he doesn't understand what God really is, what we really believe him to be. So therefore, he ends up with all these amazing statements which has to point to God, but at the end he can't accept God. So then what becomes his God? It's the universe. At the end of the day, his God is the universe. He's very much a believer in what we call now in modern science the anthropic principle, which means that it's against all possible odds that any human being can emerge from this universe. It's impossible. As you're going to see in a few minutes, one of the statistics we're going to see, it's virtually impossible, and yet it happened. So therefore, it wasn't impossible because it actually happened. So what made it happen? Design? You can't call it an accident. Now, I know I'm sounding like a religious fundamentalist by saying that, which I never want to be sound like. That's really one of my bad things to say. I don't want to be that ever. But when you study all the science and you come to that conclusion, you have to say that there's something guiding this. Some design, some intelligence. So what you're getting at over here, and again, there are multiple books on this, Science of God by Schroeder, PhD, MIT, and Schroeder's suggested the Big Bang, who we'll discuss, who talks about how 6 days could equal 12 billion years, which is an interesting trick he does. I like that. It was good. And especially, this is very well regarded, Issues in Science and Religion by Ian Barber, because you're the history of science and religion. It's a great book, right? He's a brilliant PhD in science as well as a Baptist minister, so he's very good about that. So all of these books are now telling you that it's all coming together once again. So now, what I'm going to... Sorry?
Any rabbis writing
books? Rabbis. No, they're busy studying Talmud and metaphysics. Yes, we're doing, no. Good point, no, it is not.
This is a rabbi that wrote Permission to Believe.
Yeah, I didn't like that book. That was a fundamentalist, and I didn't like it. I mean, it was sort of like reading, it just saying without proving. I wasn't really happy with it, I'll tell you the truth.
Back in the Vatican.
I'm sorry?
Those rabbis are back in the Vatican.
Right. Because what you're going to see is that he committed, from the Rambam's point of view, the arch sin. The arch sin is when you have a belief and use all kinds of science to prove that belief. He put the
belief first.
The belief first. Who does that? The mutakalimun. Mutakalimun with this in the Islamic world, you have the same exact stuff going on in the Islamic world. You have the intellectuals, the philosophers, and you have the religionists. In the mutakalimun world, you had the Mutazilites and the Asharites. The Asharites were the right-wing fanatics. They said everything, God is everything, everything that falls down is God does it, everything that causes the crisis is God doing everything. The Asharites were more sophisticated. And they had a proved religion. So they would use every scientific proof they had to prove what they already knew at the beginning. That's not the Rambam. Rambam is intellectually honest. So what they want to do, what the Rambam does, is that he's going to explore out of the Descartes everything anew, and to wherever it takes them. Complete openness to all that. And I'm going to prove that to you next week from Moreno Bochim 225, where he's willing to accept anything and everything if it's true. Period. They're only willing to accept, as is this book, what's true if it confirms my original belief. So it's not intellectual honesty at all. There's a book that I read when I was in college, Men and Gottlieb, somebody remember these things, 35 years ago, called The Inescapable Truth by Gottlieb. So you read the whole book and he quotes a line out of Aristotle and take every single line that proves God, even though Aristotle's God is not his God. No, Aristotle believes in God, they probably believe in God. It's nonsense, ultimately. It's not real. Nor is Avieza's book really very good. I didn't like his book very much. It's well regarded, but I didn't think it was very good at all. Because he proves there was a massive flood. So Bishop was about a massive flood. What was the massive flood? 300,000 years ago. So if it was a massive 300,000 years ago, that proves Bereshit.
I guess the difference is if he's writing a book to try to help people that are trying to find a way.
But you got
to
be honest and intellectually true. It's Rabbi Indiel. It's interesting. There was a discovery made about 15 years ago by Gedecky, who's an archaeologist at Johns Hopkins down south. And he found an inscription that proved Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Or at the end, what he didn't say, he misinterpreted it. He didn't know the hieroglyphics of it. So this rabbi harped on that to prove Exodus. You want truth. I believe in truth. So therefore, I'm not going to only believe in that which is true. I'm going to have my realm of I don't knows and my realm of proofs, and I'm going to work with that rather than try to only prove scientifically that which I already believe in. So that's where I'm coming from. Okay, now, what I'm going to give you, I made about 20 copies of this, The New Convergence, which is about science and religion, which I thought was a decent article on this topic. You can take it from, I'm just going to begin it. And it's going to lead us into the next area, where we're going to come back to you. I'm sorry, I don't know your name again is?
Howard Hassel.
Howard's point that we're going to see the spectrum of different ways of approaching this topic. Haramban is one. Ramban is another. Rashi is another. The rejectionists, the integrationists, the truth deniers or seekers, all that we're going to cover systematically next week. Let's look for a minute at this ironic statement where it's all coming home again. But David's point and Saul's point is all true. We may part company again. Intellectual honesty demands not only that we pursue truth, but also become aware of our own limitations. So one has to balance out this intense intellectual effort of trying to know, but also being intellectually modest as well, because also we cannot know. So although now there's a convergence of science and religion, and you're reading about it all over the place, in the New York Times on Tuesdays, on the Sunday Book and Review, George Will, all over these books, you're reading all about the science and religion, but there may be a point where we're going to part company as well. So we have to approach this with intellectual vigor as well as with intellectual modesty. David.
Even though David Henry said I used up my quota for the night, I can't keep fighting it. Why? What do you mean? You're not talking about science, pure science. You're not talking about pure science when you say you may part company. Because you're not parting company over the truth. The science...
Oh, not at all. No, of course not.
You're only parting over some political...
Not necessarily political, but...
Problem.
No, over science. Oh, no, there are those...
We're going to say that science is not right?
No, we're going to say that whereas now everybody's on this science and religion bandwagon, and that I do believe that science is an avenue towards God to looking...
That's saying that science and religion are two different things.
They are.
Understanding God...
We're going to come to this.
Understanding science is understanding God's creation, so...
No, part company in that. How do we fit in Bereshit to all this?
Harmonizing.
How are we going to harmonize or integrating all this? So we may discover something in science that's going to, science is something that's going to be a problem.
Isn't it the Rambam who says we must reinterpret?
If it's really true. But you before said that science is going to change our tradition now. So our intellectual modesty...
Reinterpreting and keep reinterpreting.
Right, so that we may part company temporarily and come back again, we'll see. But right now we're converging again. We'll see how we do that issues next week. Look at this article. After centuries of battle, scientists and theologians are finally proposing a grandified theory, think eternity equals MC squared. Right? Now, the ancient covenants and pieces. Man knows, this is a quote, man knows at last that he is alone in the universe, unfeeling immensity out of which he emerged only by chance. That's exactly the opposite of what religion will say. There's no chance from our point of view. So pronounced, the Nobel Prize winning French biologist Jacques Monod in his 1973 treatise only 30 years ago, Chesnessy, which maintained that God has been utterly refuted by science. Right? When I was in college, we had to do a paper on disproving God, that God does not exist. That was one of our assignments. There's an article by J.N. Finley who attempted in this article to disprove God. Now, ultimately, we disproved his disapproval. Thank God. Somebody got that. That was a rough one. If not, I'm going home right now. You know, it's like 2 hours anyway. So, we did disprove that. But that was one of our assignments. It was a very difficult assignment because he had a logical assignment to disprove God. That was 30 years ago. Philosophy. This is philosophy.
How did he define God? Because, like, every time you read these proofs, you look at their assumptions first, and that's usually the easiest way.
Maybe. I don't know.
Lecture.
I'm sorry? Different class. Right, yes, yes.
Your assignment particularly, usually when you...
No, you read his argument. He wrote an article disproving God. God does not exist.
I understand.
So his
but
task was...
you disprove something, you have to define it.
He did. He did. He did. He defined it. He said, I'm going to disprove this concept I have of God. You accepted his premise.
Right, if you accepted
we did. But we did. Oh. That was the way that we played the game. So we did. Then we had to find flaws in his argument. There are those who prove God as well today. Both ways. Okay, so the divine is fiction, faith is hokum, existence is a matter of heartless probability. This wasn't just speculation, but proven. What a credible statement. The essay, which had tremendous influence on the intellectual world, seemed to conclude a millennial debate. Theology was in retreat, unable, this is true of the 1970s. Anybody who was in college in the 70s was aware of the attack of science on religion. We all experienced it. Theology was retreat, unable to explain away Darwin's observations, intellectual approval of slung films such as Nobel winning physicist Steven Weinberg, right? Who in 77 pronounced, quote, the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it all seems pointless. So very much against what we believe. Yeah, so.
So if you're at a point where science is an inroad of religion where it doesn't
matter,
right, in the 70s.
Right. What do you do?
I do, but let's say 40 years ago.
What did I do?
Right, at that point, how is that intellectual honesty if science, which is supposedly based on intellectual truths?
No, not every scientist is intellectually honest, first of all. Because sometimes science itself goes way beyond the realm of its allowable... It's allowable parameter, thank you. It's allowable parameter. Science does it all the time. So you're taught, along with the YU, so there you were taught both sides of the coin, and you were taught, you had atheistic professors as well as theistic professors, and in every realm that you entered in, they taught you the limitations of science that left room open for belief.
Science was based on theories.
And some of it was based on theories. So when they would, that's when he says proven. And that's, they said they proved something. Well, I'm from Missouri. Show me your proof. So all that was part of it. But Weinberg was a very powerful challenge. Stephen Weinberg was one. And still is. And still is. As you'll see as we go along. So the answer is intellectual honesty demands that I'm open to all this, but I don't necessarily commit my life to the results of intellectual honesty, knowing that my intellect is limited. There's a little room for beliefs. And I say, I may not understand this fully. Look, how does one believe after the Holocaust? Which is a completely different realm and different class. But there are many Jews that could not believe after the Holocaust. Which Rubenstein, one of the theologians of the 20th century, said, I can't believe in the same God of the Bible after the Holocaust. So what do we answer? What do we say? Do we answer, we know why the Holocaust happened? No, we don't know why it happened. But we still say, it's only a partial part of the picture, we're willing to say, I'm still going to believe despite the attack and challenge to my faith. So you study faith and reason, and you try to figure out, what would Rambam do in those days? What would be his answer to this? So you try to play with those concepts. Biblical criticism is the same. They're all attacks on religion. The theological attacks on religion. They're all psychological attacks on religion. No free will. All of that is attacks on religion. So when you go to university, you get the tools by which to analyze, compare, and come to you whatever conclusion one can come to. Yeah. Just one more minute. Theodore was in retreat, unable to explain those religion. Intellectual approval was flowing to thinkers such as Nobel Prize winner Steven Weinberg. So he said, pronounced, the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems it's pointless. In 81, the National Academy of Sciences declared, religion and science are separate and mutually exclusive realms of human thought. Case closed. Separate and different. Right? And now, reopened in recent years, Alan Sandage, one of the world's leading astronomers, has declared that the Big Bang can be understood only as a miracle, quote unquote. Amazing statement. It's a miracle, Big Bang. Right? Charlestown's Nobel-winning physicist, right? And conventional of the laser said that discoveries of physics, quote, seem to reflect intelligence at work in the natural law. Biologist Christian D. Duve, also Nobel winner, points out that science argues neither for nor against the existence of a deity. There's no sense in which atheism is enforced or established by science. That's the limitation science has to acknowledge. You wonder why these guys don't understand this. So it's really obvious. And biologist Francis Collins, director of the National Human Genome, that a lot of scientists really don't know what they are missing by not exploring the spiritual feelings. That I wrote on the side, a little silly. Yeah, I didn't like that. That's silly. That was just silly. Because it's not a question of what they're missing or not exploring. Ever so gingerly, science has been backing away from its case-closed attitude towards the trusted unknown. Conferences that bring together theologians are not recently taking place at Harvard, Smithsonian, Big Deal, right? The emotional science and dialogue on science, ethics, and religion. Science luminaries who in the 70s shrugged at faith as gobbledygook, B.O. Wilson and Stephen Jay Gould and Carl Sagan have endorsed some form of conciliation between science and religion. Right? Yeah, so, Allah Shalom, right. So, with Stephen Jay Gould as well. That proves the point. So, when you read, if you want to read for homework this article, we'll come back to it next week, as well as talking about the spectrum of opinions, rabbinic opinions, about what to do with this issue of science and religion. Ranging from rejectionists, integrationists, to those who accept. Harambam, Ramban, Saj, we'll cover all of that next week. Thank you. Have a nice evening.
Thank you.
Arbit inside.